Election College, Episode 35. Garfield is inaugurated and his presidency is short.
Let's throw a political party. Face it, the political scene sucks, but did it always? It's time for Election College, and class is in session. Now, your hosts, Jason Goff and Ben Smith.
So, Ben, it's 1881, and James Garfield, he's our man.
I mean, if he can't do it, no one can, right?
Right, yeah. So, as we know, in 1880, the Republican National Convention got a little crazy. It was held in Chicago, and after the 35th ballot, Garfield emerges as our man.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess you could say it was a bit of a compromise between a couple different factions, but definitely what you can say is that the Republican Party, not so unified at this time.
Yeah, because you had the stalwarts, and they were people like U.S. Grant and some of his cronies, which I say crony for a reason, because it was pretty much a crony system. Their philosophy, the stalwarts that was, their philosophy was basically, hey, we are elected, and we have a lot of clout, and it's all about who has clout and who knows who.
And we're better than you, so we should actually be elected.
Right. And Garfield was from a sect called the Half-Breeds. I don't know if that was really a euphemism or a term of endearment, but the Half-Breeds were called Half-Breeds because they were accused of being only half Republican.
Yeah, usually the term Half-Breeds is not used endearingly, but let's just pretend like it is in this case.
Yeah, and so the half-breeds, yay, half-breed, they were known for being very much on the end of, hey, you qualify, you deserve a position based on your merit instead of who you know.
Right, yeah, it's more of a capitalism system rather than a caste system, I suppose you could say, almost.
Yeah. And so probably one of the leading people on the half-breed side was who would become the Secretary of State under Garfield's administration. It would be Blaine. And Senator Blaine was, or I should say is, somebody's name that you need to know about as we go forward.
Yeah, he's kind of the new and improved, not new and improved, but almost like the new Wizard of Oz.
Right.
Move over, so, Hamilton.
Yeah, Blaine is our man. So really, Garfield, he is inaugurated, and between the election and the inauguration, he's trying to get all of these people to come back together and be friends again.
Yeah, he's really just trying to assemble his cabinet, for one, and for two, trying to put things back together as far as the Congress goes. Everybody's split. Nobody's really leaning on each other for help. Everybody's kind of just, there's a lot of infighting. And so he's trying to put together his dream team of the cabinet to help him really push through a lot of these issues and assemble people from that he seems, what's the word, deemed appropriate, I guess, that have earned the position.
Right. And all the while in this, we have Blaine in the background, and it's even rumored that, you know, he had watchmen on Garfield at all times just to make sure that their philosophy was moving forward. But even right, in spite of this, you did have some of the stalwarts who made it to the cabinet.
Yeah, so we've got a couple names that most of us probably don't know, myself included in that. I did want to mention that Robert Todd Lincoln, the son of President Lincoln, was actually the Secretary of War at the time. So that's kind of a cool little throwback.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's cool to have a Lincoln in the house.
Sure, why not?
Yeah. And you had people like William Hunt, who became the Secretary of the Navy, which I mentioned that because Garfield was pretty influential in helping the Navy come back, as it were. Right. You had William Wyndham from Minnesota. He became the Secretary of the Treasury. And Thomas Lemuel James, he was the Postmaster General. I wonder, Ben, have you read much about what the Postmaster General did in this era?
I've read a little bit just because of stories that surrounded other things, but not specifically about the Postmaster General, no.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that in the last several episodes, that title has come up. And when I think of Postmaster General, I'm not thinking, oh, this is a really active part of government today, but it certainly was back then. I can imagine that interstate commerce really relied heavily on the post office, and maybe that eventually has something to do with interstate commerce, perhaps.
Right. Yeah, I suppose so. To my knowledge, it would have been a similar position as it is now, but probably at the time it was much more impactful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So really, Garfield was very busy trying to form alliances and get people to come back together, being aligned on the same side, that is. And it was actually said that by the time his inauguration comes around, that he was really distracted. And he was known as being a really good orator, but his inauguration speech, some of the witnesses say that, you could tell he was distracted.
Yeah. Yeah. He just wasn't quite up to snuff. He did emphasize the civil rights of African Americans. He was quoted as saying, "Freedom can never yield its fullness of blessings so long as the law or its administration places the smallest obstacle in the pathway of any virtuous citizen." And I mean, it says smallest obstacle, but some of those huge obstacles that we're looking at that time are things like, oh, I don't know, being able to live without being chased down and beaten. Right. Or the jail. So, I mean, not only that, but also the little stuff too. Like, can we get people to share buildings with each other? But I digress.
Yeah. So the appointments of stalwarts to the cabinet really infuriated members of the half-breed sect. And you had this going on back and forth. People just really upset with one another. There was a huge difference in philosophies because you had the merit system versus this kind of caste system. You had people being appointed positions allegedly so other positions could be vacated, so new people could take those positions that were vacated. Just a lot of infighting there. And it caused just a lot of trouble and disturbance there early on.
I wonder if that was actually the case or if it was just accused of being the case, because we oftentimes see things like that in our modern society where we're like, oh, they obviously did that in order that this could happen. And in reality, maybe it was just a fluke. I don't know. So I wonder if there actually was any of that happening, at least as much as the opponents claimed there to be.
Yeah, I'm sure that was the case. And
it got so bad, people being upset with each other and people thinking corruption, people actually practicing some corruption, that Senator Conkling and Senator Platt resigned their Senate seats to seek vindication. They decided that we don't want to take this anymore, and we're going to show you by giving up all of our authority over anything, which, you know, doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And so then, like, after they resigned, they were like, oh, okay, we'll just elect somebody else. That's cool.
Right. So there were some other reforms that Garfield really tried for. You know, Grant and Hayes, they both advocated civil service reform, and there was some reform going on. Now Garfield was sympathetic to that. He believed that the spoils system or this kind of caste system, it damaged the presidency and really distracted everybody from the more important concerns of the time. Some of these reformers were disappointed that Garfield had actually advocated limited tenure only to the minor office seekers and actually gave appointments to his old friends. But in spite of this, many people still remain loyal and they supported Garfield. So just to recap that, you had Garfield, who was known as the positive half-breed, acting more like a stalwart, but not really.
Yeah. maybe in practice, but probably not in intent, I would say. It probably certainly seemed like that. One of Garfield's big things, as Jason mentioned briefly, civil rights, really wanted to make sure that civil rights were improved and education was improved amongst African Americans. I guess at this point, that's really the only people that anybody is sticking up for, because there's probably lots of other marginalized groups. But at the time, obviously, African American civil rights were huge and very important and still are very important, but he's really a strong proponent for that, for Reconstruction, continuing the things that had been started and I guess you could say pseudo concluded during Reconstruction. So those were big parts of Garfield and his party's platform.
So in this era, we have improved technology and we have more of an international thing going on. We've got large groups of immigrants coming in from China, which you kind of alluded to just a moment ago, Ben. And we alluded to in the last episode, there was a lot of racism going on there. But you actually had an expansion of foreign policy during Garfield's short administration. You actually had James Blaine as the Secretary of State really looking to increase relations in the Western Hemisphere. You know, for a long time, we had the Monroe Doctrine and the philosophies going there where we are looking after, as Americans, the interests of the Western Hemisphere, that we're going to try to keep the British and other European powers out of our side of the planet. We should also mention that this is the time when the United States looks to begin the concept of how to construct a canal in Panama without the inclusion of the British. And then also you've got this group of islands in the middle of the Pacific that Great Britain has a great deal of interest in, and so do the Americans, those islands being Hawaii. So you had really the impetus of relations going on of, you know, what are we going to do? What are we going to do outside of our current borders?
Right. We've been having such a hard time figuring out what we're going to do inside our current borders, and people trying to make new borders and all sorts of crazy stuff going on that we've kind of forgotten that there's stuff outside.
Yeah.
At least we looking back on history, I mean, we haven't really talked about foreign policy a whole lot for a long time, but yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, Jason. Hawaii is a huge thing, especially as it relates to as it relates to our relationship with Britain.
So Ben, there's this guy. His name is Charles J. Gateau.
Uh-huh.
And he's kind of reminds me of one of those guys who just kind of shows up to the party and he's kind of on the fringe and you don't know if you should be nice to him or just kind of leave him alone or lock him in jail. You know that type?
Yeah, I think I do know the types for sure.
So at the 1880 Republican convention, remember that?
I don't remember it specifically. I've read about it.
Well,
I'm not the crypt keeper over here or anything.
Right. Well, at one of the committee meetings in New York back in 1880, he writes this speech called Grant versus Hancock because he thought U.S. Grant was going to win the nomination.
It made sense.
Yeah. And after Grant didn't win the nomination, he revised the speech to Garfield versus Hancock. I've heard of people like this, right? You know, yeah, they sure. kind of get on your side and they're a little strange. They're a little off, but okay, whatever. So Garfield is inaugurated and he's all in Washington and everything. And he just keeps on pestering Garfield.
Yeah. And Guiteau was actually wanting to speak at the committee convention. And either it ended up that he wasn't asked to, or he was asked to, and he was so nervous that he couldn't. But either way, he figured that the speech he wrote and the book he got printed and everything, or I'm sorry, the speech he got printed was so important and went so far towards Garfield's victory that should make him able to receive the consul position in Paris. And meanwhile, he doesn't speak any French. He doesn't know any foreign language. He really hasn't done anything that important, except he wrote a speech about Grant and then renamed it about Garfield.
Yeah. So really, Secretary of State Blaine was like, okay, listen, dude, leave us alone. I think he had some stronger words than leave us alone, but he's like, back off.
Or I'm going to hit you. I think that's historically accurate. He said, back off or I'm going to hit you.
Yeah.
So they basically would see Guiteau. He'd come and ask for a position. They'd say, nah, go away. He'd come and ask again. Nah, go away. He'd ramble his mouth off to other people out and about, and they'd say, go away. And you're not qualified. You didn't earn this. You didn't do anything good enough to deserve it. All you want to do is go to Paris and eat baguettes. And basically, he just continues to push. And starts continuing to get really upset about it.
He's like, I'm going to kill the president.
Well, that's a good reaction. I mean, that's what any logical person would do.
Right. And he's like, okay, I'm going to kill Garfield. And what's going to happen is that gets rid of the half-breed, right?
Oh, because sure, yeah.
Because the vice president, Arthur, was a stalwart. So he has it in his mind that he's actually acting justly, that he's going to do this thing and it's going to be great for the country. It's going to be great for the Republicans. And he's really trying hard. So he goes and he thinks to himself, Charles, the president is going to be at this train station and most of Garfield's cabinet was going to be at this train station and all of his friends are going to see him off and that'll be where we do it. So Guiteau, he takes out his revolver. He shoots Garfield twice, once in the back and once in the arm. And this was in the morning. And he runs off, and the police officer catches him. And the police officer was like, what in the heck did you just do? And Guiteau is being led away, and he goes, I did it. I will go to jail for it. I am a stalwart, and Arthur will be president.
So basically, he's like, go ahead, kill me, because I just shot the president. I mean, that's a kind of an offensive thing to do, right, at the time especially. Yeah, they pretty much, right. They don't just throw you in jail for a while or anything at this point.
Right. So, you know, I just mentioned how a lot of his cabinet members were at the train station. You know, among them was Robert Todd Lincoln. You can imagine how traumatic this is because just 16 years before, he watched his father die from an assassin's bullet. But Garfield is taken back to the White House. He's not dead. And his wife was actually in New Jersey. They come and get her to come back to Washington and spend some time with him. It's kind of ironic here, just to show you how, I don't know if ironic is the right word, Ben, but Blaine actually tried or thought about killing Garfield earlier, but his wife was present. And right. he thought that that would be too traumatic for his wife to see. So he waited till she was gone.
Right. Yeah. And basically at the time, everybody, all the doctors are like, oh, man, we got to get the bullets out of there. So I have an idea. I'll just stick my hand inside the bullet hole.
Yeah, good idea.
Yeah, I mean, why bother to put gloves on or use any antiseptic or anything like that? I'll just give them some morphine, and we'll just, you know, wipe our hand off on our pants or maybe the bottom of our shoe and just put it right in there.
So he was having all kinds of crazy hallucinations and everything from all of this infection and everything that's entering his body.
Well, like, the pain too has to be outstanding, I'm sure.
Yeah. Like, somebody told him that Chief Sitting Bull, who was a prisoner of the army at the time, that he was starving. Garfield said, "Let him starve." And then he said, "Oh no, send him my oatmeal." you can imagine that this was not a happy time. Ben, did you hear this one about Alexander Graham Bell?
Yeah, he came around and he was like, "Hey, I've got this metal detector I came up with, because that's what I do, because I'm Alexander Graham Bell. I make stuff, and then it becomes really popular later, and people get rich off my inventions." So he tries to use this metal detector he had come up with, and he couldn't find it. Still, he couldn't find the bullet.
Yeah, and they actually say that if the doctor would have allowed him to check the other side, that they probably would have found the bullet.
Really?
Yeah. They said the metal detector was actually being thrown off by his metal bed.
Wow.
Yeah.
How unfortunate is that? That's one thing you would think that Alexander Graham Bell would be like, you know, we should probably not do this on the metal bed.
Right. He's like, "I'm Alexander Graham Bell. Trust me, I know this."
Yeah. Well, they continue to try and find the bullet, and they continue to keep him comfortable, and he's just not really getting better. Later on, he takes a turn for the worse, and by later on, I mean like days or weeks later. His temperature gets way up. He suffers from some more complications of things, and he's losing weight like crazy. He had wanted to, before all this happened, he wanted to get out of Washington for a little while and go somewhere a little cooler. And then, so while all this is happening, they actually agree to move him out to Elberon, which is, I think that's in New Jersey. And they take him away and take him out to kind of be relaxed a little bit, I suppose.
Yeah. It's really crazy, too, because in the summer heat, they actually devised a makeshift air conditioner where a fan would blow over a block of ice, and it lowered the room temperature by like 20 degrees, they say. So there was some advanced techniques that they were using in spite of doing things like, I think they said a doctor actually punctured his liver by kind of feeling in there and with his finger and so on. So pretty rough.
Yeah, absolutely. So even more to that point, they say he probably could have actually survived his wounds. It wouldn't have been that bad. But I mean, they didn't have any kind of sterilization practice. They didn't know that sometimes it's okay to leave the bullet where it is if nothing ill is happening. And then of course the puncturing of the liver and, just the fact that he was shot twice. So that didn't help things, but all those things put together with little medical knowledge, he probably could have survived now, but at the time he was pretty much done for.
Yeah. So just a few months later, after the assassination attempt, Garfield dies.
Yeah. And of course, Guiteau was indicted for the murder. And then he was in a trial where he was disruptive and he argued with everyone. They used the insanity defense and said, no, he should be let go. He's insane, obviously. And instead, the jury is like, no, he's guilty. Put him to death. And he actually was executed later that year. But they found out that he actually might have had syphilis, which,
right,
if you know anything about syphilis, can cause some mental impairment, among other complications as well. But I still think if you're going to shoot the president and you have enough knowledge to know that, you know, you can clearly communicate why you're doing it, it's probably not solely from a mental impairment, but it is possible that contributed to things.
Yeah, there's actually, Ben, there's actually a cartoon from that era that shows this guy, Guiteau, as being like a clown. Like, he was just nutty. He taught himself how to fire the gun shortly before the assassination, and they say the first time that he shot the gun, it knocked him over. And he just didn't know. He didn't know if he was coming or going, really. After he shot the president, he actually dictated an autobiography to the New York Herald, and he ended it with a personal ad for a, quote, nice Christian lady under 30 years of age. he was just totally unaware how much people hated him.
Yeah.
He really thought that he was doing the just thing by getting President Arthur in office.
And I mean, this isn't an excuse for any of the great atrocities of history, of course, but I really don't think I know of many. I can't think of many instances where something terrible has happened, whether it was an assassination or genocide or war or whatever, that didn't start out with someone thinking this will help people or this will help the greater good. It's always a case of a misjudgment, a bad judgment, in thinking that something's going to help.
Right. So Guiteau ends up living longer than any of the other people who have assassinated presidents. He lived, I think it was about 9 months after the assassination. And they say that while he was being led to his execution, he was smiling and waving at the spectators and to the reporters. He was just happy to be at the center of the attention.
Man, I think I know some people like that too.
That's scary, Ben. That is very scary.
I know.
But more about that, he said that they say that he danced his way to the gallows, shook hands with his executioner, and on the scaffold, as a last request, he recited a poem he had written during his incarceration, which he called the poem, "I Am Going to the Lordy." And he had originally requested for an orchestra to play as he sang his poem. That request was denied.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, so the last view that people got of him before they put the mask over his head was him smiling.
Yeah. He is pretty goofy looking. I just looked up a picture of him.
Yeah, he's got the creepy eyes.
Yeah, definitely. I think I would have known that was coming had I met him. Yeah.
Hindsight's 20/20.
I suppose. Well, as with all types of heads of state, there was, of course, a public funeral and viewing and everything. So Garfield's train, the funeral train, actually left Long Branch. It went back on the same track that it had come on, and he was transported to the Capitol, where there was a viewing, and then he went on to Cleveland for the burial. They took his body there, and over 70,000 citizens came and walked by his body as he was in Washington. And then 150,000 came to Cleveland, which the amount of people in Cleveland was about 150,000. So pretty much everybody, wow, the whole population of Cleveland came to see him laid to rest.
Yeah. And actually, he's laid to rest in a very ornate tomb there in Cleveland, next to his wife. And you can visit that, I believe, in the summertime. It's open for you to view.
Yep. It is pretty cool looking. It's like almost like a castle.
Yeah. So shout out to Cleveland.
Yep. You did something okay. You made a cool tomb, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to understand, Ben lives in the Pittsburgh area and I live in the Cincinnati area. So
yeah,
just a little fun there.
Yeah.
So Ben, anything else about the assassination of President Garfield?
I mean, just that it's weird. Like, it seems like he was impactful, but he was in office very little time. And of that time, much of the time was spent in a bed recovering or not recovering, I suppose it was, from some gunshots. And he just, like, I still know his name. Like, the guy that didn't do a whole lot, you know his name 150 years later.
Yeah. And I think the only official thing that he ever did between his wound and his death was some sort of extradition order, some fairly minor piece of, I don't know what you would say, not legislation, but a presidential duty. That was the only thing that he carried out after that. So,
yeah.
James Garfield.
There you go, folks. If you want to learn more about James Garfield, you should. I don't have any kind of reading rainbow pitch or anything here for another book for anybody, but he's an interesting guy and an interesting childhood and an interesting turn of events for sure.
Yeah. And if you would like to do a little bit of research and find a resource about President Garfield, you can head over to audible.com, where I'm sure there's something available. If you go to electioncollege.com/audible and it's your first time on Audible, you'll get a free download if you sign up for the first 30 days.
Yep, absolutely. And don't forget to check us out, not only just our buddies over at Audible, our nameless faceless buddies over there, but also make sure you come check out our names and faces on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Election College, as well as our website, electioncollege.com. And we'll share in all the memories together.
Yes. And now that Twitter has a heart next to it, it's just all that much more special. So, all right, we'll see you next time.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.